Hello, Mainly fans. I'm your co-host, Ian Saxine, here as always with the excellent and ever accomplished Tiffany Link. Tiffany, how are we doing?
Hi, Ian. Good. I'm feeling really accomplished. Very well introduced today, I guess.
I mean, you are the companion of a top 15 dog in America's Best Pets or something like that now, right?
Indeed. Yeah, we made it to the top 15 of America's Favorite Pet, me and little Gabby, but sadly didn't make it to the top 10, you know, but that's okay. We had a good time.
Our show today will also involve some dogs. Why is that, Tiffany? What are we doing today?
Today, we are venturing into the north to some Arctic exploration topics, which definitely involves dogs and a little about snowshoes, ice-equipped ships, and more.
Excellent, excellent. So in this far north exploration, we'll be dealing with some debates about who got there first. Some might call these debates polarizing. I know. That one sank. That one was bad. Disastrous.
I can feel the collective eye roll.
The collective groan like a ship stuck in the ice. Yes. So, this is a good one. So I don't think we have any other business of the day. We should just shove off. We should begin. Yeah.
Yeah. To boldly go, right?
To boldly go where our show has not gone before. So this is going to be one for the, I think just like there's like World War II buffs and Civil War buffs. There's definitely Arctic and Antarctic exploration buffs.
Yeah, I think there's something still really romantic about the poles, because it's still hard to get there. You know, it's not something everyone can do and not something everyone has seen. So it's still a little mysterious and it feels a little untouched.
That's right. That's right. Well, all right. So you buffs out there who were waiting for an episode like this, wait no longer. Let's do this.
All right, so we are here today with Genevieve Lemoine, and we'll let her introduce her job and where she works, as it's a lengthy and intricate title.
So distinguished.
Yes, very.
Very. Well, I don't know about distinguished. I'm the curator and registrar of the Peary McMillan Arctic Museum at the John and Lyle Gibbons Center for Arctic Studies at Bowdoin College.
Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
The first question that us as Mainly history, it's our duty to ask is, well, Maine is closer to the Arctic than many states, but why is it that Bowdoin has this dedicated Center for Arctic Studies in it? What's its claim to do that?
Well, it's partly in our name, Peary and McMillan, both Arctic explorers, both Bowdoin graduates. But Bowdoin's history in the Arctic actually goes back further than those two even. The first expedition that Bowdoin College sponsored, along with Williams College, to the Arctic was in 1860. Okay. And then another significant expedition went in 1891. So we have a very, very long history. And Maine generally has a long history with the Arctic. Fishermen went down east and then down the Labrador fishing in the Arctic for many, you know, for centuries. So there are lots of connections.
My employer does not sponsor Arctic explorations, even though I also work for a university. Ridgewater State, get on it.
There's still time.
Yeah, we do great stuff, but we do not sponsor expeditions to the pole. So then I guess the other just start off question is then for folks who are interested, but not super familiar, Peary and McMillan, who are these two individuals?
Robert E. Peary. He wasn't born in Maine, but he grew up in Maine. His mother's family was from Maine, and his father died when he was young. And he attended Bowdoin College. His biggest claim to fame is that in 1909, he claimed to have reached the North Pole and to have been the first expedition to do that. There's lots of controversy around that. And because of the nature of the North Pole being frozen water floating around in the ocean, it's impossible to ever prove whether he was there or not. But he thought he was there, and he made that claim. And he was already by that time very famous for having spent decades trying to get to the North Pole and being involved in Arctic exploration, which in those days, in the late 19th and early 20th century, was like a moonshot. I mean, they were, you know, famous the way astronauts are famous. So that's Peary. Donald McMillan is another Bowdoin grad, whereas Peary graduated in, I won't get the year right, in the 1870s. McMillan graduated in 1898. So there's a big, you know, generational difference. But McMillan first went to the Arctic in 1908 on Peary's last expedition. He was part of that North Pole expedition. And he was in his 30s at the time, but he fell in love with the Arctic and with working in the far north. He never went back to his job. He was at that time a teacher at Worcester Academy. He never returned to Worcester. He just became...
Why would you?
Himself.
I mean, if well, that was exactly. an well, option, I mean, you know, like yeah, explorer. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. He fell in love with the Arctic, and he kept working there until 1954. He continued going on expeditions. So in the museum, we have collections. Our core collection is actually from McMillan. We do have Peary material, but the bulk of his materials are in national collections like the National Archives. But it means we have, you know, long decades and decades of photographs and objects and journals and things like that related to the North. And they kept both of them, went to the same places over and over again. So we have sort of community histories for Northern communities. So it's exploration history, but it's also the history of towns in Labrador and Greenland.
Do you know what sparked their interest in being Arctic explorers? I always think it's really interesting to know the drive behind that, because it's not an easy endeavor in any stretch of the imagination, even today.
Well, there is a famous in the world of people who study Peary, at least, a letter that he wrote to his mother when he was a young man. He had graduated college, but he was still quite young. And he was determined to be famous and to make his name in the world. And Arctic exploration in those days was a big deal. And so he decided that, like, the last big geographical prize, as they called it in those days, was the North Pole. People had been everywhere else. In fact, they hadn't been to the South Pole, but the poles were it. And so he, in very early on, put his mind to being the first person to get to the North Pole. And for him, it was originally a way towards becoming famous and accomplished. But he also, you can tell in his writings, he grew to love working in the North. And that's something that happens to a lot of people. You go up there and it's such, you know, people talk about it as, you know, so cold and dark and horrible, but it's beautiful. And you really do fall in love with it. And you learn, as Peary, you know, one of the most important things that Peary did really was to learn that he learned very quickly that the Inuit, who were living in the Arctic and had been living there for many, many, many generations, they didn't have a problem with the cold. And if he learned from them, he too would be able to survive in a way that earlier expeditions hadn't really been able to. So,
and you said he kind of did it right by having sort of lived there and studied there for many years, decades,
exactly,
before the actual push for the pulse.
Well, yeah, there were many pushes before that last
right.
one
the
that failed.
Push,
yeah,
yes.
But he learned from every single one of them. You know, he was trained as an engineer, and he just, every time something didn't work, he thought about why it didn't work and how he could make it work better. So
how did he pay for all of this? Where was the, I mean, I know a lot of early explorers of this era were collecting money from different societies or governments, but I mean,
exactly,
as you said, there were several failed attempts, so you gotta keep people thinking it's gonna happen sometime.
Right. Well, it was getting to the North Pole was considered, there was kind of an international competition. And so there was kind of a nationalistic bent to it. And so he was able to raise money from wealthy business interests in New York, particularly, to back him. And so eventually, in the, I forget when it formed, the a bunch of businessmen formed the Peary Arctic Club. And they contributed money and raised money. And these were people like Thomas Hubbard. If you've been on the Bowdoin campus, we have Hubbard Hall. Hubbard was a Civil War general and a very wealthy New York businessman. Morris K. Jessup, who was head of the American Museum of Natural History. You know, people, you know, famous people with lots of money put their hopes and dreams of getting, of America being the first country to get to the North Pole on Peary. And so they put in a lot of money, yeah, to do things like build him a custom-built ship and send it north and outfit it and everything like that. And
So,
eventually that.
unlike the space race, this was not government sponsored, though.
Absolutely not. Yeah, it was
Okay.
private money. Peary was in the Navy, but he would take leave from the Navy to go on these expeditions. They would release him from his duties. So yeah, it was not government sponsored. Yeah, it just was a lot of nationalism involved, but not national money. Yeah.
You mentioned the British and the Americans, and definitely the Norwegians got involved
The
once they became an
Italians.
independent country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I mean Russia was, close too. Did they was the Russian Empire sponsoring expeditions in the 19th century at this time that were competing with Peary and his contemporaries?
You know, I don't think they were. I think it was largely, and even just trying to think, Britain had pretty much stopped. It was very much dependent on having an individual to really push for it. And
Well, I
so
mean,
you
Britain
get.
had lost, several pushes for like the South Pole and.
But it really was, I think, Norwegians, Italian, the Duke of Abruzzi,
The airship, right? That like flew over the pole, or is
Andrei's
that,
balloon.
yeah.
Yep. 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 But yeah, to be honest, I don't think there was a Russian, seriously trying to get to the North Pole at that
Interesting.
time.
Yeah, just given that like they had access. So I find that a little surprising. But then it's also I'm one of the people who would not have tried to go to the North Pole.
No,
So Tiffany would. And
Oh,
so
you
we
would,
have different attitudes towards exploration on our team here.
It's they, when I think of it, they have a lot of Arctic coastline, but they're not actually that as close to the North Pole. Even today, when people try and go to the North Pole, they go from,
Greenland,
well,
East
actually from
Coast,
Northern
or
Canada
yeah,
mostly.
Canada.
It's
Okay.
Greenland is it's too hard to get to Northern
More,
Greenland, so they go from Northern Canada. Well, now they don't go anymore at all. It's the
Now,
ice is in too bad condition.
so was Peary involved in looking for the Northwest Passage as well, then, Jenny?
He was not. It that didn't seem to interest him at all. He was so focused on getting to the North Pole. The Northwest Passage was first attained during his career. Amundsen sailed through over many years because of getting stuck in the ice, but that wasn't Peary's. It wasn't his objective, and so it just he didn't feel threatened, I don't think, by the way he felt threatened by other North Pole people. He didn't feel threatened by the Northwest Passage people.
Did he last, like, this will sound like, no, I can never promise my last amateurish question, but were the North Pole crowd threatened by or in a rivalry with the South Pole crowd?
No, not really. I mean, Peary actually talked extensively during the North Pole expedition with people like Macmillan about then going and mounting a South Pole expedition. So he was confident, perhaps while he was in the Arctic, that he could manage a South Pole expedition as well. That never came to pass. And Bartlett, who was captain of Peary's ship, the Roosevelt, he also considered a South Pole expedition, but never followed through with it. I don't think they felt that it was they envisioned them as two separate accomplishments and in a sense independent of one another, so that if somebody had gotten to the South Pole before they got to the North Pole, I don't think that would have mattered so much to them. But
But
in fact,
also, if
because they
you're,
hadn't, it opened up the opportunity of doing it.
and if you're like the first person to get to the North Pole, why would you risk not going out on a high, you know, and not achieving that South Pole.
Yeah.
I would think if it were me, I would just be satisfied.
You wouldn't be satisfied.
But with my North Pole victory,
right.
especially when not attaining your goal could mean that you died in the Arctic or Antarctic.
Right. Yeah. In the Antarctic.
So, you mentioned the ship.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because it was sort of conceived by Peary and built in Maine by Maine Lumber, correct?
Yes, absolutely. So the Roosevelt, named for Theodore, Peary essentially designed it. He certainly specified it. And it was built at the Mason and Dix shipyard in Verona, just outside of Bucksport. You can actually still see the waves if you go up to Verona Island. The shipyard is long gone. It, in fact, I think went out of business shortly after building the Roosevelt. But you can still kind of see the waves near the bridge, actually. So it's kind of interesting. But yeah, so it was built right here in Maine. There was lots of debate over how good of a ship it would be. Apparently, the shipwrights used to joke that it would never float because it was so buttressed on the inside with wood. You know, there was no hold, no storage space below decks. It was all buttressing to make it strong so that it could withstand the ice. And it did withstand the ice. But it did, the fact that there was no storage below meant they didn't have a lot of space for coal. So they had to have coal, another ship come up with coal to deposit in Greenland for them to pick up on their way home. And it complicated things a lot. There's lots and lots of great stories about the Roosevelt.
It needed a special bottom, right? Like a hull, like in the sense, besides thickness, wasn't it rounder than a typical ship so that it would sort of pop up instead of getting crushed in the ice like a lot of earlier ships did?
Right. So it was designed, and there had been other ships like the Fram with similar designs meant to, instead of getting crushed, as you described, they would get lifted up by the ice as it closed in on them. And could withstand, it was strong enough that it, even if it wasn't getting lifted, it could withstand the pressure of the ice. And it could actually, it was designed to engage the ice. It had a sharp prow and they could ram the ice to break it. It was in a sense, a very early form of icebreaker.
Oh.
They would also, Peary and Bartlett would also use, as Bartlett described it, his friend, Mr. DuPont, would help them out. And they would set off dynamite to break up the ice, which didn't always go well. At one point, they were setting it off. The ship was in the ice, and they were trying to clear ice from the stern. And George Wardwell, who's the chief engineer of the ship, he was saying, like, don't you think you're a little close to the ship with that dynamite? And they were like, no, it'll be fine. And it wasn't fine. And they set off a charge and everything in the engine room leapt up and down. And so every bolt and every connection to the ship was broken. And it took Wardwell days and days and days of work to get the engine going again. But he did, and the ship did get home. So yeah,
did they take that ship on multiple expeditions, or was it just the last one?
Two expeditions. So it went north on its first voyage in 1905, and they overwintered at Cape Sheridan in the winter of 05-06. They didn't get to the pole that year. They came back, and they barely made it back because they had damaged in that explosion, in addition to the engine room going crazy, they had damaged the rudder, and ice further damaged the rudder. So they sailed home. They left Greenland in September 1906. With not much of a rudder and very little coal. And so they motored home, they steamed home as much as they could, but they sailed when they had to. They were, by the end of it, they were just sailing, using the sails to steer the ship. Bartlett was an excellent captain. He could do that. Along the coast of Labrador, they were stopping and getting, there wasn't any coal to be had. They were getting like fresh cut spruce. They were treating it with cod liver oil to make it flammable, to burn, to keep the engines going. And finally, they limped into New York Harbor on Christmas Eve of 1906, with no steerage. They rammed the Wall Street Ferry, and then they got to dock. And I mean, people had almost given up on them. It was a really terrible, terrible journey home.
This was
a reason they went further south to New York rather than stopping at like Portland or somewhere
right,
along
that New
the
York
way.
was the
It's just
home port at
better.
that point.
Okay.
They had stopped in Sydney, Nova Scotia, so they had stopped and wired back, so people actually
Okay.
did know they were coming at that point. But they, even in Sydney, I don't think they could get, they got coal, but they couldn't repair the rudder well enough to steer. So it was.
This was the end of the expedition that Peary claimed that he got to the North Pole.
No, this is the one where
they
had failed in.
Oh,
in
sorry.
1906.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then they spent 1907 repairing the ship and redesigning it slightly, and then left again in 1908, and that's the expedition that McMillan went on. In fact, Peary had asked him to go on the 1906 expedition, but he just signed a contract with Worcester and he didn't feel he could break his contract. So he was maybe the only person who was happy that Peary didn't make it to the pole in 1906.
So I imagine our listeners can think of some things that were clear obstacles and dangers to getting to the North Pole. Oh, it's really cold, you know. Oh, there's ice in the way, so you have to walk or sled for part of the way. What are some other dangers that Peary and the people traveling with him had to overcome that maybe people wouldn't necessarily expect?
Maybe if you talk about, you know, they had to travel over ice, and they did. They left from Northern Ellesmere Island, and then it was just ice all the way to the North Pole. Only it's not only ice. It's the ice breaks, even in the middle of the Arctic winter, even before climate change. The ice breaks, and you get what are called leads, open water. And this is what happened in 1906. They got a certain way out on the ice, and then there was this huge crack. Too big. Sometimes they're small and you can use a sled to make a bridge, or you can walk along it and find a place where you can cross it or it will refreeze. But they came to what they called the Big Lead, which forms frequently a very large piece of open water in the Arctic Ocean in March, you know, this time of year. And if it doesn't refreeze, you're just stuck waiting for the ice to shift again until you can get across it. And in 1906, that happened, and they waited there so long. Eventually, they did get across it. But by that time, they'd eaten so much of their food and used so much of their fuel that Peary knew that if they got to the North Pole, they might not get back. And so he called things, and everybody went back before they starved.
What was the best time of year or safest for them to go then? Because thinking the actual winter is too bad. Summer might be
too
risky. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Summer, you can't do it in the summer. Really, the window for doing it is sort of, and Peary started in February. He would start because it was just then starting to get light. And so you had enough light to travel by. But then by the end of April, it's definitely too late. You know, the ice is moving around too much. So even back then, it's just, it gets to be too dangerous. And so, and it's also, I mean, and this is something Peary noticed early on as well. No 2 years are the same. So you can't, you just have to, you have to plan everything you need to plan. And then you have to be lucky with the weather and the ice conditions on top of it all.
Right,
and that's what happened.
Like you said, there's no, unlike the Antarctic, there's no land underneath at all.
Yeah.
It's all
right.
ice. So all of it will change all the time.
Like, And so as you're crossing these leads, you know, you're at the risk of A, falling in yourself and people did fall in and get hauled out and, you know, had to be warmed up and dried off and things like that. Or you could lose a sledge with equipment on it, because you got to remember you're out there, you know, for weeks, and you've got to carry all your food, all the dog food, all the fuel that you need for boiling water, basically. It's all got to be on those sledges. And if you lose one of those sledges, then you're really, you've got no other options. It's too far out. When you get, you know, too far away from the land, there's not seals to hunt. You know, there's not animals or birds that you can hunt. You're just, there's nothing.
And the fish, so, probably, even if you could ice fish, maybe not as plentiful or not enough to sustain you over long periods of time.
I think it would, I don't know that anybody's ever fished under that solid ice. There might be fish under there. Probably are, but I don't think they, to be honest, I don't think they ever tried.
I never hear
people
talking
to shore,
about it. Yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean, close
in reading Arctic
fish,
or Antarctic, like, But I'm always like, I wonder if people just are like, why didn't they just go fishing?
Well, for one thing, if there's no open water, the ice is much too thick. It used to be much too thick to go through. But generally, I think the fish too are closer to the shallower water, I think.
And
That's
when you're
total
expending
guesswork.
that much energy, the amount of fish you would have to consume to stay healthy is probably not like a good
You'd be
ratio.
spending all your time fishing and you wouldn't be getting anywhere.
And what about like polar bears? Are they, do they encounter polar bears or not so much?
Not so much when you're further away from land. I mean, it's a possibility. Polar bears wander a long, long way, but because the seals aren't out in the middle of the sea ice either, they're closer to shore because they feed down in the shallower waters. The polar bears hang around where the seals are.
So once they truly get to like the pole approach, they're not having to worry about bears or predators.
So there's been ongoing disputes pretty much all the way up to the present day about if Robert Peary did get to the true North Pole and or if the guy's name was Frederick Cook, a rival explorer, got to the true pole first, or if maybe they both missed it. So in your as an official representative of the Peary MacMillan Museum, does your institution have an official position on whether Peary gets the medal, the golden igloo, if you will, or whatever else?
Typically we say that you can't know for sure because there is no, he couldn't, like at the South, like Amundsen at the South Pole, you can't put a stick in the ground and say, I was here. Suckers, anybody who comes after me, I was here first. It just doesn't work. He did, they planted a flag, they took pictures, but it instantly floated away to somewhere else and wasn't at the North Pole anymore. And so there's no way to know for sure. I think there's a one line of evidence that I know of that I don't have the technical knowledge to evaluate. And that is the photogrammetry studies that have been done. So photogrammetry is using things like shadows in photographs, knowing the height of something and then the length of its shadow. Apparently, you can there from that figure out where a photograph was taken. And so in the 80s, the Navigation Foundation did studies like that on Peary's photographs. And they said he was within 5 miles. They thought of the pole. Then that's a question of is that close enough? I mean, he knew that his navigation equipment was never going to, he didn't have GPS. Now you can take your GPS and you can read, see that it'll read 90 degrees and you can watch it as you drift away as and it'll change. He didn't have that. He just had a sextant. And so he knew he was never going to be able to say like this tiny spot right now is the North Pole. So actually when they got there, so Matthew Henson, we haven't talked about him yet, he was in the lead. He stopped when he thought he was close to the North Pole and waited for the other, there were four sledges, waited for everybody else to catch up. And so they established a camp. Peary took a reading there, and then he went on and did, I forget how many crisscrossing sledge journeys of about 10 miles each, just to cover the area to say that he'd been there. So he knew he could never say he was right at the pole. And so it does become a question of when is it close enough? And then it becomes a question of those studies. And I really don't have the skill to evaluate them to know for sure whether they're right or not. I don't think Peary was lying. I think he thought he was there. That's just a sense that I have. I don't know. I mean, there's no way to know that either. Maybe he did make it up. Cook, on the other hand, it's pretty clear he was lying. And the chief evidence for that, there's various kinds of evidence, but what is the most convincing is that he was traveling with two young Inuit men, and when they got back, it took them, they didn't get back to Greenland until the spring spring of 1909. And then Peary and his team met them when they were on their way home. And Matthew Henson, who was fluent in Inuktitut, interviewed them. And the interview was recorded by George Borup. And at that time, and at any other time that anybody else talked to them afterwards, they always said that they were never out of sight of land when they went out on the sea ice. Mm. And Cook did an amazing sledging journey with them, but they would have no reason to lie. They said they were never out of sight of land. And you know, Cook eventually lied about being the first to be to climb Denali as well. And that was proven to be a lie in his lifetime.
Oh.
Was he the one that died in South America or went out to look for the explorer who was on the track of the lost city of Zed? There was like a kind of shifty explorer involved in that scenario.
I thought it was something short, like Cook, but probably something different. Well, it might have been short, but it wasn't good.
Yeah.
Cook eventually got put in jail for wire fraud over selling land that he claimed had oil on it, which ironically later turned out it did have oil on it, but that was not known at the time.
Yeah, I believe he got locked up the same year as the Teapot Dome scandal, the most famous, like, odd sounding presidential scandal, you know, and maybe ever in history of Warren G. Harding and his administration selling claims in land out in Wyoming, I believe it was. Then Harding died before this came to light. And so when I read about Cook's getting caught on this stuff, I was wondering, wait a minute, was he a Teapot Dome scandal person? But, you know, the biography of him that I was looking at wasn't mentioning that per se.
Yeah, I don't think so. He had his own scandals to be concerned about. But he was, you know, he wasn't a totally bad guy. He was on the Belgica expedition to Antarctica. And as a doctor, and he was on Peary's first expedition. So that's where he first got his polar experience. And then on the Belgica expedition, he saved everybody by making them eat penguins because they were stuck in the ice dying of scurvy. And he was like, you got to eat fresh meat. So he really, you know, they wouldn't have gotten out of there if it weren't for him. I mean, he wasn't all bad. And people, you know, he still has his supporters. And one of the things that amazed me the most, actually, I was in getting a tour, you know, just a, not a behind the scenes tour, but just a usual tour of Amundsen's house outside of Oslo. And on the piano is a little embroidered thing, you know, it's a cloth that Cook made in prison and gave to Amundsen because Amundsen remained friends with him. So, you know, there's, it's really...
I would imagine most of these people who went up either North or South Pole and braved it, that they're, I'm guessing most of them, even when they were rivals, there was a general regard for each other as unusual, you know, intrepid folk. And as long as maybe there was a code, as long as you didn't violate the code of whatever their honor code was, which maybe, you know, Cook might have if he lied. So that makes it interesting that Amundsen stayed friends with him, but I could see where there might have been a sense of togetherness of all of them.
Some, I mean, they're certainly, because of the competitive nature of it, Peary in particular was pretty prickly, I think, about things like that. I'm not sure that he was close friends. I mean, he certainly made appearances. There's pictures of him with other Arctic people, including Shackleton and things like that. But I don't know that he was particularly friendly. There's a famous instance when Sverdrup was in the north and with no intention of going to the North Pole. And he and Peary were like not that far away from each other on Ellesmere Island, and Peary would not go visit him on his ship. And they're, you know, overwintering, two expeditions overwintering on Ellesmere Island, and Peary wanted nothing to do with the other one. Which is so he was a prickly kind of guy, I think, when it came to those sorts of things.
What was his relationship like with the Inuit people since he spent, you know, he really kind of embedded himself into that culture in that area for so long.
Yeah. It's hard to get a real clear view. There's certainly, you get lots of different individuals who had different reactions to him. Some people were sort of intimidated by him and frightened of him. Some people, I think, did respect him. They, in general, they trusted him to do what he would say he would do. So if he said, like, yeah, you know, come work for me and I'll give you this boat and these guns and all this stuff, they knew that he would follow through, which apparently is not the case for Cook, for example, who didn't, you know, the two young men who went with Cook kind of got stiffed, I think, in terms of what they felt that he owed them. So they trusted him. There's an interesting story, actually, from the 1906 expedition. Uta, who is one of the best hunters and who worked on many expeditions with Peary, he, many years later, told, I think, Peter Freuchen, that in 1906, when they were, you know, after they'd been stuck at the Big Lead and they had started to move on and Peary was trying to decide what to do, and Uta had said to him, like, you send everybody else back, but if you want to go on, I'll go with you. That to me says, and it, like, this is Uta telling a third person, this is Peary, I don't know, didn't really talk about that I know of. That just signifies to me a kind of, not friendship, but a respectful relationship between those two men, you know, each extremely knowledgeable and skillful in their own way. I mean, Uta was very, very respected throughout his life as a great, great hunter. And the fact that he would, you know, put his own life at risk to do something that Peary wanted to do. And Peary didn't ask him to say, you know, would you stay with me? He apparently volunteered that information.
Do you know, or do we know how Uta and then some of his other sort of kind of, you know, Inuit, you know, these elite contemporaries who were going on expeditions like this, was this mostly like a job for him to do? Or was there I could see really easily there being a sense of pride and skill that he was sought after, but was he invested very much in the idea of getting to the North Pole itself? Or were Uta and his colleagues less so, and they were like, ah, whatever, like, you know?
No, I mean, they had, as far as I understand it, their opinion on getting to the North Pole was like, what is the point of this?
Okay.
But because, you know, Peary had built up this long relationship and he paid well, not in money, because at that point there was no store there. There was no use for money, but in goods. There's also, I've heard people say that, you know, going on these long sledding expeditions, it's a sense of adventure. Inuit men are not immune to a sense of adventure as well. So there's that, you know, so there all of these things together just made it seem worth their while to do that. You know, I think there was among some people this sense that Peary was very authoritative and authoritarian in his way, and that some people felt they needed to do what he wanted them to do, but he didn't have any power to make, you know, he only really had the power of persuasion to make people do what he wanted to do, and the economic power. So they didn't buy into the idea that getting to the North Pole was a worthwhile, like, nobody in those communities would have said, oh, we're going to go to the North Pole instead. We're going to be the first people to the North Pole. That was not of interest to them.
You mentioned, Tiffany.
He took his family there with him for stretches as well, correct?
On some of the expeditions. So in his first and second expeditions, Josephine, his wife, went with him. On the second expedition, she had their first child, a daughter, Marie.
I think that must have been really, you know, visit your dad at work day in the Arctic, you know. Right.
It was, I mean, for the people in DC where they lived, it was scandalous that she would go up pregnant.
Sure. Yeah.
Very pregnant, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
She, they left in July and Marie was born in September. So she was like there was no surprise that that baby came along.
Did she give birth on a ship or on land?
On land. They had built she had brought a woman, a nurse with her as well. So she had an assistant. They knew what they were getting in for. And this was part of, you know, Peary was like, you know what, women have babies in the north all the time.
Well, yes.
You know, they live there. It's quite possible. There's nothing. They just felt that it was not that big of a deal. And of course, in 1890s, I would say hospitals are, you know, most women were giving birth at home, not in hospitals. And the conditions would not have been that different, except that there was no emergency care if you needed it. Anyway, so,
and so
Marie
did
was
Josephine
born.
Share that passion of exploration or the Arctic, or just didn't mind being along for the ride?
I think she was quite an outdoors woman, so she wasn't intimidated by going up there. And, you know, she would hunt, she would go on long hikes and snowshoe trips and things like that. Once Marie was born that following summer, she went home. She did go north again. Peary went in 1898 and got dropped off, and the ship came back. And then I'm going to get the years mixed up, a couple of years later, so 1900, she went up to bring him back. And she and Marie were on board the ship that went north to get them. And then they got frozen in. His ship, he was on Ellesmere Island, and they were frozen in across Miss Sound in Greenland. So they were on opposite sides of a small body of frozen water. And it was months before he even knew that they were there. And so she went up for a summer and spent a whole year, basically, with Marie, who was, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 or something like that, you know. So she was pretty fearless.
You mentioned the snowshoeing, and Peary kind of pioneered the use of snowshoes for Arctic exploration, correct? Like, some people weren't necessarily using that yet. Might be confusing him with another explorer, but that he kind of brought that technology with him in a way some other people hadn't before.
Right. He had snowshoes custom designed, basically, in Maine and made in Maine. I'm blanking on the name of the snowshoe designer.
So the Inuit didn't use snowshoes?
No. Most places in the Arctic, there's not a lot of use for snowshoes, because in most places you would normally go as an Inuit hunter, the snow is firm enough that you just walk on it or you're on the ice. People use snowshoes down in the forest where the snow is deeper and softer.
Okay.
But Peary, because of where he was going, was sometimes going overland. You know, you go places exploring where you don't go hunting. And so the snowshoes would come in handy. So they did. Nellie Dunham, that's who made his snowshoes. Way Maine. Okay. So he had them designed to his specifications for the kind of snow that he expected to encounter, because snowshoes can be customized that way.
So he brought his family and Uta, and there were some hunters. I think, yeah, we'd be remiss. I mean, Peary and leaders like him didn't just go by themselves. And so you mentioned Matthew Henson, who was really kind of his lieutenant for many years. If you could tell us a bit about him, and then also on that big, potentially sort of quote, true first polar expedition, who was in this party? It was Peary and Henson, and then a few other people, right? That maybe we should mention them and talk about.
Right. It was it wasn't a cast of thousands, but a cast of tens involved in the expedition. So Henson was an African-American explorer, really, in his own right. He first worked for Peary in the 1890s when they went down to, they were surveying for a canal in Nicaragua, actually, before the Panama Canal. This was a Navy job. And Henson was hired by Peary as his valet. By the time they came back, Henson was acting as one of the survey crew chiefs. He was young, but he was very accomplished in almost, as far as I can tell, anything he put his mind to, he could master. And so in 1891, when Peary was getting his first big Arctic expedition going, he asked Henson if he wanted to go along. And Henson said, sure, why not? He was up for anything. And he got a lot of grief. You know, there was a lot of racism at that time, and people joked about how could an African-American man possibly survive in the far north? It was way too cold, blah, blah, blah. But Henson thrived. He loved being there. He learned the language. He was actually one of the best dog sled drivers. Even the Inuit recognized him as one of the best dog sled drivers. He learned to hunt. He fit in really, really well with the community. And so he had all the skills of living in the Arctic. Plus, he was really more fluent in the language than Peary was. So he became a really important intermediary between Peary and the Inuit. He was very well liked by the Inuit community and still is fondly remembered. You probably know both he and Peary fathered children with Inuit women. And so, I've heard in the community stories about, what a great relationship Henson had with his wife, and he's got many children and grandchildren and now great, great, great grandchildren in the community. And they're all very proud of them, as they should be. He was very well respected by any, you talked about the sort of camaraderie of Arctic explorers, and Henson fits right in there. He was any of the Arctic explorers who knew him, and even men, I think some who probably didn't know him all that well, respected him very highly. And so it was, for instance, Wilhelmur Stefansson, if you've heard of him, who was a Icelandic Canadian and then American Arctic explorer. He and Macmillan and others who petitioned Congress to get some kind of support for Henson, because Peary kind of abandoned Henson when they got back to the States.
At the end of that North Pole expedition?
Yeah. And so it was left to other Arctic explorers really to try and get him settled and try and get him a pension from Congress, for instance.
Was that just because it was like the end of the expedition and everyone's expected to go do their own thing, or did they have a falling out, or like, what was their reason?
It was a combination. They did have a falling out over lecturing. Peary wanted the first, and by contract with most of the people, I think not with Henson, by contract with everybody else, he had the rights to lecturing and publication of the book and things like that. He had the rights to do all of those things first, and then other people could do them. But when they got back, Henson really needed money. And so he was offered a lecture tour, and he asked Peary, I think, and Peary was not very happy about it and said no, but he did it anyways. And so there was a lot of tension there over that. And yeah, Peary was, it's hard to say. He did, I think, just assume everybody was going to go their own way afterwards. And he didn't, as far as we can tell, he really didn't do much to help Henson. And this, of course, is at a time when being an African-American is not easy to find a good job, even if you're extremely accomplished.
Yeah.
He did eventually get a job in the Customs House in New York. Yeah, but yeah.
You mentioned both Peary and Henson had Inuit. You called them wives. And so I'm wondering, there's a pretty common through line in a lot of these very male heavy kind of careers and expedition type roles, whether it's fur traders, some kinds of mariners, explorers, of having often sort of local women as companions. And in many cases, it's almost kind of a formalized position or a role, or something of a, I guess to use an anachronistic term, a career that combines not just sexual companionship, but also certain other kinds of assistance, whether it is hunting or, maintaining the camp or whatever else. So were these, and if we know their names, so were these Inuit companions or partners to Henson and Peary? What were they in a formal role, or what was their relationship besides the fact that they did have children with these men?
Yeah, it was, I would say, more formalized. So for Henson, Akatingwa, his wife, I think was treated by Henson and by the Inuit community as his wife. He wasn't married to anybody else at the time. So when they were in a relationship.
Makes things a little complicated.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Peary, on the other hand, was, of course. And so when I talked to people in the community, they just talked about them as married, right?
Peary, but he didn't stay with her or she with him. Like, there was no sense that they would stay in the same place after their expedition was done.
Right. Yeah. And there's no, it's not clear how, what arrangement they came to about that, whether they never expected, you know, there's, well, we could get into the whole, you know, it coming down to the States and the problematic nature of that and whether Henson even considered staying up there. I don't know. Peary's situation was a little bit different because, of course, he was married. And in fact, his wife knew most of the people in the community since she'd also spent time in the community. And yet he maintained this relationship over a number of years with Alakasana, a young woman who was also married to Piawatu. So it's hard to know exactly what goes on, but in traditional Inuit culture, there's a formalized relationship of wife exchange where married couples will agree under particular circumstances that, you know, the wife of one man will go with the other man. You know, say one wife is pregnant and the other guy is going off hunting on a long trip and it's useful to have a woman with you, that the other man's wife might go with him and act as a wife on that trip. So it's a formalized relationship. There's one historian has argued that that's what was going on with Peary and Alakasana and Piawatu, is that they conceived of that as a kind of a wife exchange. And so that it was a formalized relationship that was a benefit to her and her family, because of course she then had access to material goods and whatever from Peary. And for Peary, it was more of a wanting to have a wife handy thing.
Was Josephine aware of this arrangement?
Eventually she was, and she was very, very upset. And there's a very touching letter. So when she went up there in 1900 or whatever it was, and got frozen in, there was Alakasana, who was pregnant with Peary's child, and not at all shy about talking about it, because it wasn't something to be ashamed of, right? And so naturally Josephine found out about it. And she wrote a very kind of heart-wrenching letter to Peary about it, basically saying that, you know, if she had known how things were, she wouldn't have come, but it was already too late, and there she was.
Had she also just recently had a miscarriage as well when that was going on, or is that not accurate?
I think the baby was born but died.
Okay.
And we don't know how they made it up, but they did. And they remained devoted to each other. You know, I don't know that there's any way to understand a couple's marriage from this distance when we know what happened, but we don't know how they communicated about it. We know nothing about that, and I don't imagine we ever will. But somehow their marriage survived. And Peary's children in Greenland grew up to be successful hunters themselves. They also have many, many descendants. And now the families are in touch. There was a big family reunion in the 80s with both Henson and Peary families coming to the U.S. And so there were lots of interactions after that. So I don't know if the following generations have stayed in touch, but there was an acknowledgement and a sort of mutual welcoming of each families eventually.
What is your institution's relationship, if any, with the Inuit community that was sort of most closely involved in the polar expeditions?
Right. So we still do have some connections there. I started working in that community in the 90s, late 90s. And then I did sort of peripheral work around in that region up until quite recently. So we still have connections with people. And in fact, one of the women I met and worked with in 1999, Navarana Sorensen, she's actually a descendant of Henson, and her sister, Belika, was actually married to Peary's grandson. And they all came down here to visit in 2001. Navarana has done a lot of amazing things in terms of work in the community and with other researchers and things like that. And we actually gave her an honorary degree in the spring. So we still have connections with the community. And I'm working with some colleagues at other institutions to try and get another project going up there that has to do with sort of the deep history of managing ecological resources. That's we'll see how that goes. It's funding dependent.
Ah, yes.
Go find some wealthy New York businessmen who are really into like nationalistic pride and going to do research in the Arctic, right?
Right.
We haven't talked about the dogs yet, and I what can you tell us about the dogs? Everybody, we have some such wonderful pictures in our collection, as I'm sure you do too.
Oh, the dogs. People love the dogs. Yeah. I mean, the dogs are amazing. I think the first thing you have to learn about dogs in the Arctic is they're not pets. They're working dogs. They're not friendly. And even other hunters, well, for instance, Masangok, who was Piri's grandson, I remember him telling a story about when he was a young man and they were crossing the ice cap from one, you know, to go over a peninsula. And he, at that point, his father had died when he was young. And so he was with his uncle, Piri's son, Kali, and a bunch of them were going across the ice cap and Kali's dogs fell down a crevasse. And they were still attached to their traces, some of them, but somebody had to go down and fetch them. And Masangok was the youngest one, and the smallest, you know, he was a teenager. And so they said, you have to go down, you know, you're the one who will go down, we'll lower you on a rope and you can rescue these dogs. And he was scared because they're not his dogs. And those dogs, you know, they like the person who feeds them, but other than that, they're quite dangerous. And he managed it. He came through it unscathed and he got the dogs out. But, you know, they're not pets. They are working dogs. And even I was there one fall and I went out on a dog sled with some of the hunters who were working with some teachers to learn enough English to take tourists dog sledding. And so I was like the practice person. And one of the things that they were learning how to say is don't pet the dogs.
You have to, because like everyone's going to want to. And that I think people associate, you know, huskies and sled dogs with like Alaska and all of that, but really there's like a sort of Labrador specific breed, I think, that maybe Piri was kind of into, but
he used Greenland dogs.
Greenland dogs. Yeah. Okay.
And in Greenland they're very, very protective of those dogs. You cannot bring a dog to Greenland. You can't. Yeah, for fear that it'll interbreed.
Interbreed. Yeah.
What do Greenland dogs look like in terms of size? And
they look like what a lot of others, like, you know, you'd be hard pressed, at least I'm not a dog person, I'd be hard pressed to tell them from any other kind of northern dog. I mean, they come in different colors, you know, spotted, white, brown, gray, black, curly tails if they're happy, furry. I don't know, they just look like dogs. We have lots of pictures of them on our website because Macmillan loved them and he loved dogs. And they're not, you know, you can make them into pets. Like if you get a puppy and train it to be a pet, it can be a very loving pet. And Macmillan would do that. He would have dogs that he would keep.
So are the photos of the dogs on, you know, the ships back here in Portland, are those the Greenland dogs? Okay.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, they might have sometimes picked up dogs in Labrador, which would have been very similar. But I think mostly they'd be, just because you don't want a ship full of dogs, they would pick them up, I think, when they got to Greenland. Yeah.
Did the dogs sleep with the people, like, you know, to stay warm? Oh, no.
No, they sleep outside. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
their coats are easily heavily enough. They don't, and if it's really snowy, they get, you know, covered in snow, but that keeps them warm, so they do all right. Yeah.
I am a dog person. So.
And you had asked about, we got sidetracked, you'd asked about the other people on the expedition.
Yes. So there was Henson, there was Piri. What were the other people who made this sort of final push?
You have the Americans on, and mostly Americans on the team. So you have Piri and Henson, and then you've got what are called his scientific assistants, you know, Macmillan and George Borup and Ross Marvin and John Goodsell, who was a doctor. And so they were the scientific team, so to speak. Then you have the ship's crew. So you have Bob Bartlett, who was the captain of the ship. You have George Ward. And so he sledged with them. But then you have George Wardwell, who was the engineer who stayed with the ship, and then a bunch of seamen. And then you have all the Inuit. And so we've talked about Utah and the Inuit men who were there, but they came with their families. So when they would go to Greenland to, you know, Etah and Cape York and places like that. And the people, the men, the people, I should say, who were going to work with Peary would get on board the ship and they all sailed over Smith Sound up and further up to Northern Ellesmere Island. So it was men and women and children who came with them. And the women were as important as anybody on the expedition because they were the ones who made the clothes. You know, Peary learned that if you wanted to survive in the Arctic, you had to do it the way the Inuit did. And that was to wear fur clothing that had been designed by and made by Inuit women. And so the wives of the men were there as seamstresses and they made a lot of, you know, they were still sewing all the clothing for their families and footwear, you know, boots and things like that. And then they made all the clothing for the men on the expedition as well. So they were there for the whole year.
You said, so there were, you know, families and kids. Were there like a significant number of, you know, like toddlers and, you know, young people
even
running around the ship kind of, you know, I'm sure they were doing, I'm sure unless you were a baby, you pretty much had a job. But were there?
Oh, not the little kids, but yeah, there were kids of all ages really. And they didn't live, Peary thought they would live on the ship, but it was too crowded and dark and yucky. And so the Inuit all went and lived on shore and they built tents until they could build snow houses. And then they would, you know, they lived on the land. And yeah, the kids were there just, you know, we've got George Wardwell took photographs. They taught them skipping, you know, they were just there, kids of all ages. So it was like a whole little town moved across to Northern Ellesmere Island for those expeditions. And babies were being born. But I think it's the women who get in a, well, the kids as well, but the forgotten about the expedition. People always talk about the sledging journey, and that was the men who did that. But they could not possibly have done it if the women hadn't been there to make and maintain the clothing.
Yeah, otherwise they'd be like the Franklin expedition, which the British famously just sort of went, well, we'll wear our own fashions. It'll be fine. Yeah. You know, all exactly. will be well.
Yeah, wool clothing is just not good enough.
While we're talking stuff, could you tell us a little bit about the kinds of items that people will see if they go look at the collections that your institution holds?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well,
like, what are some of your favorite pieces that you would recommend to folks who make the trip to see you?
Oh, let's see. Oh, I have everybody always asks for my favorite, and there's so many favorites, but one favorite that, because I've already mentioned part of this story, I will talk about. We have on exhibit in our third floor gallery, if you're coming to see us, is an ivory, walrus ivory necklace that's carved from a single piece of ivory. The loops are all
very
carved
cool.
out of ivory. Very amazing. And that was given to us. It was part of the collection that came from the Macmillans. So it had been presumably Miriam Macmillan's, who was Donald Macmillan's wife. And that was all we knew about it. It was just there. We kind of surmised because of the way it was carved that it was from Greenland, but we didn't know anything. And it came in the 70s and that's all we had. And then when I had Navarana and Balika and Masangwa were here in 2001 that I mentioned, we were going through the collections. I was showing them things and I opened a drawer and there was this necklace and Balika and Navarana immediately said, oh, our father made that. And they recognized his particular style of carving those links. That was his family secret. Now some of his sons and grandsons probably do it. But they immediately recognized it. And that was very interesting because we have photographs of their parents, their father, Javiak, and their mother, Amanalak, who worked with Macmillan in 1923-24. When he overwintered in Greenland with the schooner Boden. And so we've got lovely photographs of them as a young couple. And we know from Balika and Navarana that they stayed in touch. And every time, you know, whenever Macmillan would be back in Greenland, he would visit with his old friends, including them. And Balika remembered as a young woman being on board the Boden actually and having the doctor, she'd hurt her hand. And the doctor who was with Macmillan in 1947 looked at her hand and fixed her up. And So it was just this amazing connection of a beautiful and very skillfully made object, and then finding out how it was connected very deeply to our collection and to our contemporary connections to the community. So that's one of my favorite objects. There's so many. I don't know.
Do you have a favorite picture of maybe, and you know, usually you think of some of the explorers, oh, they're there with the flag or something, but you talked about there's a picture of the kids skipping or something. Like,
yeah.
Are there other kind of candids like that in the collection?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, we do have a lot of photographs. Thinking of some of the ones on exhibit that people could see, most of our photographs are online, so you can go look at them anyways. But on exhibit, we put up a series of photographs of the schooner. We haven't talked about the schooner Bowden really, but we've got a series of pictures of the schooner Bowden on the rocks. So the Bowden was Macmillan's ship, which was launched, also built in Maine, launched in 1921, and he used it for most of his Arctic expeditions until the 1950s, and is now this official sailing vessel of the state of Maine. And the Maine Maritime Academy uses it as their sail training vessel out of Castine, so they still sail it. They took it to Labrador this past summer. They keep it in beautiful shape. Anyway, but the Bowden was built to withstand ice and to withstand knocking up and down the coast, because the waters, particularly in those years, were very poorly charted, and you didn't have, you know, sonar, radar, whatever, to look for underwater rocks. And so they were all, not always, but often running aground. And we've got a whole series of pictures from the 1920s up until the 1950s of the Bowden, you know, sitting out of the water on a rock, waiting for high tide to get back up. And for all the times that happened, and sometimes it looked pretty dire, she never stove in. She always made it home. They always got her off the rocks and got her home again. So that's a fun series of pictures to look at, actually. Yeah.
You talked a little bit about Macmillan and staying in the Arctic and continuing to do expeditions, but you know, after you've achieved this awesome goal of the North Pole, what does your life look like after that? What did Robert and Josephine do? And I mean, I know that they were older than Macmillan, but do you just slip off into lectures and retirement, or does he keep, you know, going north?
No, he never went north again. He came home in 1909, and you know, then there was, yes, of course, lecture tours, you know, in North America and to Europe and places like that, writing the book, doing all that kinds of stuff. But basically a kind of retirement. He was not the kind of person to ever stop working altogether. He got very interested in aviation and was writing articles and things about aviation for coastal defense, for modern, you know, because this is, by that time, you're in the run-up to World War I, in a sense, using aviation to monitor coastlines and things like that for national safety. But he was also ill. You know, he was, all those years of hardship in the Arctic took a toll on him. He had what was at that time called, I think it's still called, pernicious anemia. And so he was, you know, getting blood transfusions to maintain his strength and things like that. And so he died in 1920. So he didn't have that long of a retirement, even really. He spent as much time as he could on Eagle Island. That was really his most favorite place to be, on the coast of Maine. He split his time between there and DC, where they were living at the time. But yeah, he was, you know, he was called upon, you know, for his expertise and things like that. But in a lot of ways, he did sort of ease into a retirement. Yeah.
And the Roosevelt, did it continue sailing, or?
It did. It got sold off. The Peary Arctic Club actually owned it. So when Peary was done, they sold it, and it had kind of a checkered career. It worked as a, I think the first person who bought it wanted it to be a yacht, but that didn't work out, and they sold it on. Eventually, it became like a working boat. Somebody took it up to Alaska, and it was a working boat in Alaska for quite a few years. And then in the 30s, they were sailing it back to the East Coast. It ran aground near the mouth of the Panama Canal and was abandoned. And at one point, maybe in the 50s, Marie went to see if it could be raised and preserved as a historic vessel, but it had been too badly eaten by worms and things like that. So basically it's gone.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, this all kind of being in the run-up to World War One, and I mean, for one, like you said, these are sort of like the culmination of the last unexplored places. You know, the poles are both discovered, and then you've got Shackleton trying to traverse the Antarctic, and all of this is happening on the eve of the war. But do you think that that's sort of what ended this age of exploration, or was it more just a sense of like we've checked off all the boxes? But Macmillan's obviously still going north, doing some kind of research and explorations.
But that's it. There's a transition, you know, after, well, even before the war, after the North Pole expedition, a transition to an emphasis on science. And so Macmillan and George Borup, who had were, you know, together on the North Pole expedition, had come up with this idea. They wanted to keep exploring, but they knew that they couldn't just go do an exploration expedition again. They'd never get the money for it. And so they hatched a plan that involved a heavy research component, which was the Crockerland expedition, which was Peary in 1906 from Ellesmere Island had thought he saw land west of Northern Ellesmere Island, which he called Crocker Land. Crocker was one of his financial backers. And in fact, Cook had also reported seeing land in that direction. And a scientist, Rollins from the Geodetic Institute, looked at tidal data and said, oh, you know, it is possible that there's land out there because of the way the tides work. And so Borup and Macmillan used that and other science that might happen in the Arctic, because it was a blank slate as far as science goes, pretty much, to come up with an expedition that would be sponsored by the American Museum of Natural History. It was supposed to go in 1912, but shortly before they left, George Borup died in a canoeing accident. So it got postponed till the next year. Macmillan went with five scientists and ran that expedition, where they showed that Crockerland was a mirage. But they collected lots of specimens and did other science. And it was a disaster in its own way, because they went for 2 years and they spent 4 years because they couldn't get back. But that's a whole nother long story.
I don't think most people realize that a lot of these landmarks are not even named for the, you know, the explorer, the somebody who shows up and says, this is, I'm naming it for me or my roommate or my king or whatever. But no, this is for my investor. Sorry, Inuit, you're actually living on my investor's island here. That's great.
Some of those names are getting changed back, finally, to their proper Inuit names. But yeah.
The investors are dead anyway. They've rented it for long enough. The naming rights. Yeah. It's like a baseball stadium. You know, you get the rights for a while.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about anything that you're working on that our listeners should keep an eye out for?
Well, we've been in this new building of ours for our exhibits opened in May, late May last year. So almost we're coming up on having been here for a year. And we're working on the first of the new replacement exhibits to go in here. Our wonderful photography exhibit is sadly going to have to close. Inuit Kinangangi, which is five Inuit photographers. So if you want to see that, you have to come. I forget its exact closing date, but it's in mid-April. So come quickly if you want to see that. It's a fantastic exhibit. But then if you come in towards the end of May, and they'll be advertising about this, of course, we're working on a new exhibit, which is about monsters in Inuit mythology.
Ooh. So awesome. That sounds
lots
great.
Of scary, great, scary creatures and amazing artworks. So,
ooh,
it's
so maybe this is
maybe you're our next Halloween episode.
Yes.
Or I was saying, right.
Or like Tiffany, great. do we hear a live show coming potentially at the monster exhibit?
Yeah, sure.
Which we've been talking about. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, that would be super fun.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I have to say our attendance has been through the roof.
Oh, excellent.
That's great.
Really good news.
And then outside of the great stuff that you have going on, if our listeners, as they're getting psyched up to see the new monster exhibit, is there any book or exhibit that you would recommend to our listeners that maybe, you know, maybe a book about Peary or anybody affiliated with him or something that you would recommend to people wanting to get started on this?
Sure. I mean, there's some amazing books out there right now. We are going to have, so this is partly something we're doing. We're going to have Daryl Hartman here talking at the end of March about his book, Battle of Ink and Ice. Mm. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a book about, it's about the Peary Cook controversy, but through the lens of the media and the press and the way that modern media, in a sense, the New York newspaper establishment grew out of that, in a sense, and how they fed on each other, I guess, is maybe a way to put it. But it's a really, really different and interesting perspective, an important perspective, actually, on that whole controversy. So that's a book. And of course, Daryl's from Maine. So he doesn't live in Maine now, but he is from Maine. And so we're excited to have him come and talk about his book here. And I think I would recommend that as a good read if you want to get into the Peary stuff. That's an interesting place to start.
I've heard really good things, so I'm glad it has your endorsement as well. So, yeah. Just to let everyone know, does the museum have regular winter hours, or are you cut back a little bit for the moment?
No,
or?
Our hours stay the same all year round. We're open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 until 5, and Sundays from 1 until 5. We're closed Mondays and national holidays, and around Christmas often we'll close, but check our website. If there's a big holiday, check our website, but generally those are the hours.
Great.
Well, Genevieve Lemoine, thank you so much for speaking with us about this, getting our polar knowledge started here. I'm really excited to check out this museum, and hopefully we will be speaking with you again sometime.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, it's been very
lots
nice.
To
thank
explore.
You for having me. Yes. Lots to explore.
And that's our show.
Check in with us on all social media platforms if you haven't already, so that you don't miss out on all of the extra content that you would otherwise miss if you were not following us. Good people. Tiffany, where might that be that people can find us?
We are on Instagram at mainly.history, Facebook at mainlyhistory, Twitter/X. At Mainly History, extra dots or dashes. And then you can always reach out to our Gmail account at mainlyhistorypod@gmail.com.
That's right. We want to hear from you, much like the family of an explorer who's been away for a very long time. We want to hear your thoughts and feelings about our own adventures and yours.
Throw out some episode suggestions too. Mm-hmm, you know, we're always up for new topics or new viewpoints, new thoughts.
If you've been to the North Pole, let us know.
Oh, absolutely.
That's right.
But you got to prove it somehow. Yeah. It moves around.
You know, it'd be amazing. I don't know if there's Wi-Fi up there. If somebody was able to listen to Mainly History at the North Pole, I would feel very proud. Well, no, because we have a map of all the countries people have listened so far. And it's a big one. We've got serious.
I'm going to guess there's probably no Wi-Fi, but you could download it and take it there with you and then listen to it.
It'd be a very meta experience.
It would.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the new Mainly History Challenge. Download this episode. Go to the North Pole. Listen to it. And take a recording of you doing it while you're doing it.
Yeah.
And then send it to us. And in exchange, you will get, I don't know, do they get to like a picture with Gabby and Lenny? I think if somebody does that, we can.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll find a way. we'll meet with.
That seems like a very small prize. I mean, Gabby and Lenny are pretty awesome, but.
They are.
We'll, if you do that, we'll think of something awesome.
That's right. We will arrange for you to meet our pets. Lenny has never been on the road, but if you listen to us on the North Pole and take a video of you doing it, I think he'll make the trip. And eventually, if we get big enough, we'll get better prizes to give out for doing completely arbitrary stunts like that. So that's why you should rate and review us to help other people learn about our number one show in local Maine history / podcast category. I don't know, that's narrow enough. I think that covers it, yeah.
Yeah, reach out to your friends and family. You know, if every person had one more person looking, that's a lot of new people.
A lot of people. The doubles are already formidable numbers. I like
Indeed.
It. That's all for now, everybody. Remember, if you're going to the North Pole, wool is not enough.
Not enough. Bundle up.
Goodbye.
See you next time.